Welcome to Emotional Sobriety, the next step in recovery with Dr. Alan Berger and Tom Rutledge.
As a lover of Stoicism and Marcus Aurelius, what did you think of the part in Meditations where he's like, you must greet each day, rushing to meet it because of the purpose, you know, required of you? Yeah. I love that
because it keeps you focused. It's like it's your job to be the best person you can possibly be. That's the job you do. You know, we're here to do this stuff. We're here to serve other human beings. You know, he also says wonderful things like, you know, you're going to get up every day and you're going to meet assholes and just, you know, don't worry about that. I mean, it's my words, it's not his, but, you know, don't worry about that. That's what people are, and they're going to, you know, I mean, he doesn't. There's nothing namby-pamby positive about it. He's just basically saying, no, just, and that's what I love about him. Just get up and be the best version of you can be.
Well, you know, your word's not his, but he was thinking it. He was thinking whatever the Roman word for assholes was.
Oh, yeah. Well, I'll find that little section. It's when it's at the one, being in one of his books. I'll read.
Part of me will always be an asshole.
Oh, God. I'm grateful that part's never gone away. I mean, I feel like I can manage him well, but it's like, no, that's too much of my personality. Because I bet this is true for both of you, probably. But Joe, I know for you, it's like even when you don't do the asshole out loud, you can entertain yourself with him in your head.
Okay. October 8th. Sobriety is like a merry-go-round. It's easy to stay on when you're in the middle. You can fly off when you're on the edge. Heard around the rooms. Some of us loners isolate and feel apart from the recovery community. No wonder we are tempted to quit recovery when we stay on the perimeter. All the centrifugal force is encouraging us to bolt out the door. If we want recovery, we push through the resistance and work our way into the middle of the merry-go-round. We get contact information from 3 or 4 or 5 members who will welcome our calls, texts, and emails when we are panicking, need to unload, or talk through our difficulties. We might not be comfortable with contacting strangers so we can make test calls. We reach out even if we are feeling good, just to break the ice. Hey, just calling to touch base. This expands our comfort zone and prepares us for when the shit hits the fan, which will happen in sobriety. Some can make it without a network, but we are social beings. To engage with others and participate in the process is to be in the middle of the merry-go-round. Jumping in improves our chances of not flying off the edge. Steps 1, 2, and 3 involve surrendering to the fact that recovery won't happen strictly on our terms, by doing it how we've always done it. Getting active improves our chances of long-term recovery. We can find a group that needs a greeter, someone to set up, clean up, or help with some kind of behind-the-scenes work. Feeling nervous? Do service. Feeling a part of significantly improves our chances of avoiding relapse. Arriving at meetings last, being the first to leave, and skipping the socializing may be natural. Relapse is also a natural for addicts. It's worth thinking about how natural we can afford to feel or be. What does willingness mean to me? Do I take my addiction seriously? Am I still willing to go to any lengths to enhance my recovery?
I don't like being in the middle of the merry-go-round. It's like, yeah. It's like, I don't know that that's really different than it ever has been, but I like what you're saying is a little bit what you and I were talking about with Marcus Aurelius just a second ago, Patrick, is what it is. It's like, okay, well, tough luck, do it anyway. Do your job. That's what we were talking about. Marcus Aurelius talks about your job is to be the best human being you can be today. And that's what you're describing. Best person in recovery is the best we can be. And, you know, do it even though it's not it may not feel natural. It may never be natural. But do it.
Yeah, I think it's it's more fun at the edge of the the thrill comes at the edge of the merry-go-round, right? When you're feeling cold and wonder if you're going to fall off, right? Mm-hmm. And I think it's just important to know where you are and question why you're there, right? Like, you can, if you stay in the middle, like you said, that's no fun. You can have a life of complete rigidity. And you don't call it rigidity, of course, you call it control. I'm in control. And there's no spontaneity in my life if that's all I'm doing. And if I live a life of total spontaneity with no order to it, you know, you know, how am I going to get anything done that way? Right. That's right. But living that range, I think, is the key to it. And like the idea of not only, you know, getting phone numbers, because, okay, this will add more order to my life, but just calling people even when you're not in a panic and talking to their voicemail.
Oh, man. I remember when I was first in, I'm going to sound like an old man here again for a second, but the first in the program, back when we didn't have email or text or any of that stuff, and it was we had to make phone calls. And it's like, I remember, you know, there was a fellow that I knew that he had this little tiny, very tiny little lettering on it. He scroll that he would bring out, and it all had numbers he had gotten since he began recovery. Now, back in those days, our numbers changed all the time. Every time we moved someplace, so he said most of these numbers are probably not any good anymore. But he said even if I spend my day going through the numbers and calling them, it's still a day better spent, you know. And then the other thing I was going to add when you said that was I remember also another fellow that we learned so much just from listening to other people talking in these programs. It's he was serious about this. He would say well, I'd get phone numbers, but then I would, he said I'd just call them to be sure they gave me their actual number. You know, just in other words, I'm just testing. That's exactly what you said. Oh, yeah. I'm just testing to see if he's on the other end of that. I need to know. And he made it really clear that it's okay. Just to, I could, you know, if I'm new in the program or if I'm old in the program, I can call you up, Joe, and say, like, I just needed to know I could make the call. You know, you go, great. I'm glad you did. Anything I can do for you? No, got to go. Bye.
Well, like, part of why we isolate and feel apart, it probably has something to do with the fact that, like, it's easier to control the floodgates when it's just us, ourselves alone. And I think part of the medicine of throwing ourselves into a fellowship, because that is like the thing that AA brings to the game, or any kind of like social-based recovery program, is that that is the medicine, is that, like, you know, you are relinquishing control a little bit to kind of like the herd. You're absorbing yourself into the herd, and it's like a, you know, it's a brotherhood, or it's a sisterhood, or it's like, you know,
you are letting go of control, Patrick. It's like, it's, I mean, being in any kind of group like this is like bumper cars. You know, you go in, you're just minding your own business, and then somebody else has something to say, and all of a sudden you're going, oh, fuck, you know? I got some of the same kind of stuff. And what you were saying is you're right. If we can just keep control of the floodgates, I love that line. It's like, it's not real control. It's just basically trying to be invisible.
Well, some people think, I mean, they will look at the idea of having to go to an AA meeting and get 5 phone numbers and then call those people as like, that's just so burdensome. I mean, like, I'm already struggling to stay sober another day. Now I got to call this crazy person and like give them my status update and welcome them into my, you know, my carefully constructed barriers. Like it's a little counterintuitive, isn't it?
This is not the subject, I guess, but it's like the thing, you know, first of all, I just think all the time it's always changing things if people have any resistance to things. Somebody says, I don't want to get those 5 numbers. I said, well, how many numbers do you get? It's a negotiation. Like you get somebody's half of somebody's number. It's like, and the other thing is to take the expectations off of any rules. I know there are people who are going to say that. So you need to do this and you need to do this check-in. Just make the call, you know, and then you just say, I know it's hard. It's something, probably one of the hardest things you'll ever do, but just do it. And just try to give permission rather than, instruction.
I was reading today some work by Patrick Carnes, who wrote Gentle Path of the 12 Steps, and he's very big in process addiction, sex and love and intimacy and all that sort of stuff. And he talks about how principles, which people often refer to the 12-step construct as a program of principles, and how they're different from rules. Like, like, for instance, maybe we should see the process as a recipe. And now, first time I get a recipe, I follow it exactly because I have no idea what to expect, but that's the last time ever. If you love my chili and you want to come back for it, you're never going to get that bowl of chili again because I'm never going to make it the same way twice. And that's the great thing about once you learn the principle, like by practicing it by holy rote, you can stay true to that principle if that's your thing. If you love the controlled, rigid practice that way, but in a more emotional sobriety, you know, you're more empowered. Like you can add more blueberries to the pancakes, or you can add more butter or more flour for a different experience, right? It's not getting it wrong, it's doing it differently. But add, you know, codfish to it, maybe it's a bit of a mess, right? You know, so there are some limits, right? And even making bread, you know, the recipe for making bread is probably a recipe at sea level. If you're at 8,000 feet, you need to make it differently.
Did you listen to our episode from last week, Joe, by any chance?
Yep.
I liked what Michael was talking about his program, you know, a little bit indirectly. But, you know, I don't think he goes to a lot of meetings, but he's very involved with his spiritual advisor and obviously with his creativity. And then I think that, you know, he was pretty open about like how dropping in on our podcast it was a little bit like, you know, his meeting for the week, you know, it's just fellowshipping with a couple other sober people. And, you know, he's like many decades now clean. And I was just thinking the other day how wonderful that is that, like, you know, it would be a pretty unconventional, you know, program for a lot of compared to like maybe some of the guys I see every week at my men's stag. But absolutely, you know, it's served him well and it's allowed him to flourish in all these areas of his life. And that's his recipe. So like, you know, just to your point about how, you know, once we get stable, you know, we get to decide, you know, a program of life that works best for us.
Well, and the other thing that goes with what you said, Patrick, is who are we to judge? Because, I mean, that's one of the things that and I, you know, I mean, I can screw this up before the day is out. But in terms of having judgments, because those judgments comes as automatic thoughts. Those are not thoughts I go looking for consciously. Those are thoughts I need to respond to that just show up. And so you see that a lot when other people and people are kind of in a situation where they're comparing and contrasting their program with other people. It's like, you know, your attitude is like, you know, there's a teacher and writer who writes a lot about spirituality stuff. And one of her favorite lines is when somebody confronts her with something that they don't like, she just says it beautifully always. And it's just it's calming. She just said, well, it works for me. You know, and it's just to hear her say, it's not confrontive. It's not harsh. That's the end of that conversation.
Well, let's get back to this real quick. What is it about the social component that feeds our recovery? Because people are tests of our emotional sobriety because they don't act according to our design.
No shit.
You know, yeah. I mean, the whole, you know, emotional sobriety and cultivating it is about handling constant challenges to our design, the way that we think things are supposed to go, and then adjusting to that. And so, like it's hard, like just having to call people, deal with their people ways is can be a test. And, well, you know, what's the argument for, I suppose? I don't know if we've touched on that entirely.
Well, I mean, last time we were talking about personal relationships, romantic, sexual relationships, and how, you know, being in relationship, if you talk to someone, you know, who's looking through the lens of like attachment theory, they'll say relationships aren't to make you happy, they're to make you grow, because it confront, you know, like that solitary, you know, walls up kind of approach through life is safe, but it doesn't offer the same opportunities for growth as confronting people who don't see everything the way I see them, right? There's my opportunity for growth. There's where emotional sobriety gets tested, right? If you're trying to choose a sponsor, everyone's heard this, you know, go for a ride in his car or their car with them, right? And just see how they react to things on the road. It's like, things don't happen the way I want them to. And then I start to think, you know, that's not right. It should be a different way. And that's kind of like saying, this bull shouldn't attack me because I'm a vegetarian.
That's right. That's true, though.
You know, like, it's just not accepting life as it is, right?
Well, this fits in, too, because I've been looking for, I found it, Patrick, and this in terms of just other people. This is Marcus Aurelius. When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. You know, that's what we're saying. So I love that. Basically he's saying that is what it is, man. It's like, you know, that's the shit we can't control. But that's the stuff we can learn from, like what you're saying. It's about how I respond to that's where my growth comes from.
The people in New York and Texas really should get along better. You know, they've got so much in common. Sorry. Anyway, continue.
I grew up in Texas, and when you do that, when you're born in Texas and grow up in Texas, regardless of what's happening in Texas, I'm completely glued to my Texas ego, you know. And I remember the first time I ever was in the airport in New York when I was going to Europe on a college trip. It's like, I mean, because it wasn't always that way in Texas, because I remember being so offended by just walking around the fucking airport, you know, just Kennedy Airport, about how people just were so rude and so, you know, and I don't know if they were really rude. They just weren't, you know, hey, howdy, how are you doing all the time, which is what I was used to growing up with. But I think you're right. I think they may have more in common now.
When you read that, I thought, I've home group, and tonight's the night for our district meeting, and it kind of helped prepare me for that. So would you read that again?
Book two, and the first part of that, it's the thing I love about Marcus Aurelius's Meditations is he never wrote it for publication. He never wrote it to anybody else. This is his journal. He's writing to himself, and even when he's giving instructions only to himself. When you wake up in the morning, tell yourself, the people I deal with today will be meddling, ungrateful, arrogant, dishonest, jealous, and surly. You know, and he goes on to say, they are like this because they can't tell good from evil. You know, but I have the beauty of good I have seen the beauty of good and the ugliness of evil, and have recognized that the wrongdoer has a nature related to my own.
Yes.
I was talking to somebody the other day who just was starting therapy, and she was saying, oh, God, I hope I don't have anything in common with my mother. And I'm going, you know, just giving her the intro. I'm going like, you're going to have a lot in common with your mother. You know, it's like, especially if you don't want to. That's what you're going to find out is that's, you know, and I just gave myself as an example. I said, man, I had trouble like hell with my mother, but all those things that I could list in these adjectives like Marcus Aurelius does with my mother, what I found is they represented a big part of me, you know. Now I got the good parts of my mom, but those are the dark, that's the shadow, you know, that's the dark part of the mom, the one I had trouble with. It's like, sure enough, I had that potential in me. And that's what I hear in Marcus here. He says, I'm, you know, I have the same nature as these people. We're just making different choices.
The way we judge ourselves is different than, or those close to us is different than the way we judge strangers or people we, you know, have friction with, right? You know, there's a lot already written about that. IA will tell you all about that, folks.
Yeah. Well, I mean, no, there's
the whole, I say IA? I'm so dyslexic.
AI.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah,
my dyslexic mind put it back where it's supposed to be.
just on that, someone was observing my father over the speakerphone. I was reading him a number, and I interchanged the two middle numbers, and he wrote them wrong also, getting it completely right. And and the person on the other side goes, do you two have like some sort of code that you
like
talk
father,
in?
Like son, nice little, you know, synchronicity.
That's one of the funniest like joke structures I've heard in a while. Yeah. the dyslexia kind of, you know, the universe writes itself, you know, through collaboration. Right. Yeah. speaking of parental influence, Tom, I was loving when you sent that picture of your dad, you know, and you gave us a little window, and that's where you get your funny.
The picture of my dad in a woman's overcoat, the blonde wig and the purse. Yeah, that was my dad. I was trying to figure that out. I think he was probably about 45 years old at the time. And he just standing there in the room with a straight face. And I showed the picture to my wife, and she said, is that your dad in drag? And I go, yeah.
Our high school every year had a beauty contest of boys in women's clothing, and no one ever thought it was weird, right? Like everyone came, everyone loved it. I came second, and the person who came first had bigger boobs. I think that was
I would think if you had your hair though, man. I mean, that's you're gonna look beautiful.
You know, like,
but it was just normal. It's just like, it was just fun. Well, there was
nothing,
right?
There was nothing political about it. It's not
right?
That we should be able to do that now because we there's more awareness, but it's but it was just for fun. And it was at least there was no intention for it to be at anyone's expense.
Yeah. And my mom and my sisters were happy to sort of help out, get me ready and take me out the door. And I, you know, walked to school in heels. Learning experience, I must say.
Wow, I was going to say no, because I am fascinated with women who can walk in heels. I mean, or even run in heels. I'm just going like, I don't know, you know, how you're not dead.
One thing I can unequivocally say I'm doing pretty well at this stage in my recovery is getting together with guys from my different fellowships and doing the bonding and just trying to talk through whatever the crisis happens to be, or just to, even if there's no crisis, even if we're just talking, you know, what's going on in your life, you know, like, tell me about the high highs rather as well as the low lows. And we saw yesterday, I took a bunch of guys from my men's stag to go see The Smashing Machine. That's the new movie about Mark Kerr, the UFC fighter. And it turned out to be the perfect HBMS outing because it's so much about the fighter's addiction. We can see the kind of delusion of, the guy calling his sponsor, thinking the rest of the world is crazy, you know, for not understanding, how I've got to get my guru on the wire just so that I can have a normal conversation with my significant other.
You're talking about connection. And that's in part what, you know, the October 8th talked about, you know, there's two parts of connection. And one is attachment, like, becoming part of our home group or our fellowship, whatever that is. And then the other part is the safety of feeling authentic, that I can say anything. There's no outside issue. I will be accepted and unconditionally loved no matter what I'm going through or what I've just done. And, it would be sort of liberal mythology to think I'm going to get that you know, at any AA meeting just because, you know, that's where the magic happens. Like it happens more than it doesn't, but sometimes we get, you know, you can't talk about that here, or that's no way to stay sober, or, you know, some sort of blowback. So, I mean, people aren't perfect. We're going to, a leaderless organization with other people who, you know, came there with issues just like I did, right? So two things that are great, you know, historical references to this emotional sobriety show. I was just recently talking to Dr. Jamie Marich, who was on your show, Trauma in the 12 Steps, and she recently did something. She teaches, what's it called? EMDR? Again, I'm always afraid EMDR, to talk because of my dyslexia.
EDRMQ.
Yeah, exactly. and she, it was called Queering EDMR. EMDR.
I'm having fun just listening to this. It's just so fascinating because I'm watching you and realize your brain does it all by itself. It's like you have nothing to do with it. It's like it's just that's got to be of all the other things that may be, there must be a hassle and a half.
Absolutely. That's why I became a writer, right? I could spell check. I could. But, I can picture it in my mind, seeing it correctly, and then say it incorrectly.
And it goes,
Wow. So we were talking about, the need for, that sort of second level beyond, buy-in. Okay, I'm a member here, but the safety requirement of seeing other people be very vulnerable and be totally accepted, which gives us permission to be totally vulnerable and completely honest and whole, our whole self, and to be accepted. And that, the loneliness of addiction is so great because of the lies we're telling ourselves and others, the separation we have from all of life, that is such a game changer for thriving in recovery. I mean, you can get by on recovery just by hanging out with people, but to thrive, that sort of emotional sobriety experience has to have both of those elements of connection, of attachment, a willingness to risk, right, to commit to something, and authenticity, being able to be fully integral.
Well, I had a full-on relationship with my substances when I was using. Yeah. And so a huge part of the socializing that comes with the fellowships is just like replacing that relationship with ones where I actually get a conversation and a handshake rather than a hangover and, whatever else. And
there's somebody else on the other side of the relationship.
Exactly. And I've talked about how there was a period in my life where people would call me when they didn't see me for a while, before, like, the drinking drugs got really hit a point of critical mass. And I wouldn't pick up the calls of loved ones because, I had a full-time job, of getting loaded, and I just couldn't accommodate them. And sure enough, people stop calling after a while when, you're not picking up, and my phone list would dwindle, and the amount of people who knew me, went away. And so I'll always associate with my first couple years of sobriety how much of a joy it was to just come into a room and people wanted to be my friend, and people would it was like, coming into like a heated room after being
out. They were glad to see you. They want,
exactly. After being out in the cold for like years. And so, I think that's like a huge part of this is just like, it really is the opposite. Like the fellowshipping, being with people, talking to people is the opposite of the dynamic that's created from being an active addiction.
Okay, let's talk about the personal responsibility of how what we perceive in these situations, because I'm gonna see if I can go back and gather a couple of things that Joe was talking about too. It's like you're talking about coming having these experiences of this healing experiences of the unconditional regard and the love and stuff. What I always want to say is that keep in mind that basically that's going to happen inside the broader context that Marcus Aurelius just described. It's like in the same room where you may be experiencing that love and that conditional, there's also judgment. Okay, the most important thing is we're gonna find what we're looking for, and I learned this from a lot of different places. I continue to learn it, but my first sponsor was the best. He would say, he was the one that when I came out and said one time, those guys are full of shit. He said, Tom, it's a room full of alcoholics. And then I just thought, oh, well, okay, that kind of explains it. But what he would say is if you go to a meeting, if you sit there and you get coffee and you talk to people and then you sit down and have the meeting doing it, and you walk out of there and say you didn't get anything out of it, he said, you weren't paying attention. He said, there's lots of things. He said, I don't care if you should just get the, you remember Curly in the
Stooges?
No, Curly in the Jack Palance in the Billy Crystal movies.
City Slickers.
City Slickers. He would hold that big finger up and say one thing, but he never told anybody what the one thing was. But, I think this is it. I think the one thing is you're in charge of what you're looking for. And it's like, I'm not saying it's there everywhere, but it's like, I just want, because I think sometimes people are so used, and it's not, they're not doing it on purpose, but you're so used to finding what you're not looking for, is that if it's in that room, that's going to overpower what you could be getting from it. So, I'm not trying to say that, I'm not trying to make excuses for anybody who's not treating other people well, but I'm saying, it's like, keep a focus on that. It's like, you're there seeking something in particular, and where you can find it, the person that you can see it in their eyes, the group over there talking at the coffee pot, can do that, then go toward it and it's there for you, and it's never going to come in a perfect package.
That reminds me of some artistic liberty in this story, but I'm young in sobriety. I storm out of the meeting. Another member comes out and says, Joe, what's going on? Full of hypocrites. And he says to me,
Joe, start at the top, just because you froze for a second.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
So, I'm in a meeting and I'm frustrated and got my arms crossed and I just walk out and, sort of running mate follows me out and says, what's going on, Joe? Just that meeting, it's full of hypocrites. I can't stand it. And he says to me, so you're not coming because the meeting is full of hypocrites? Yeah, damn right. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, come back in. One more won't make any difference.
You're still welcome.
My friend Josh, he's getting married this Saturday, and he's inviting a bunch of his guys from AA. And I just got a message before the recording started that to be on time for the shuttle, because they invited so many people that probably going to lose your seat. There's more people than there are going to be seats at the wedding. Mm-hmm. First of all, my social anxiety now is just like, Jesus Christ, do I even want to go to this wedding? There's so many people. But, he happened to lead the meeting, our meeting of our home group earlier this week. And he was talking about just kind of a what you just said, Joe, that like people say a lot of things in these groups. And they're always trying to give advice and, they're not giving good advice, or you don't want to take the advice, but like looking at people, what people are doing rather than what they're saying. And, it's like hypocrisy or not, there's something, there's a positive energy, you know, of people kind of sitting and being there instead of at the bar. You know, I think that's right. worth, that's remarkable, you know?
Well, it's one of the things I tell, this comes up in couples therapy a lot too. And I'll kind of abandon our gender for a second, because sadly it's needed more for men, in my opinion, than anything. And that is, we all want intention to count, you know? And it does. It really does count, you know, but it doesn't count for as much as we want it to, you know, as in maybe women, I'll let women speak for themselves. But for us, I know that it's just like, but honey, I didn't mean to hurt your feelings. It's like, well, that's good, because if in fact you maliciously hurt my feelings, that would be an entirely different problem, you know, but it's, you know, it's like, but what you're saying is, let's take in the whole picture and let the intention count, even if we're bumping into each other and being somewhat idiots, or, you know, and a lot of times the advice stuff is just because it lacks that humility that needs to punctuate any kind of guidance like that, which is to say, you know, I don't know if that's going to work for you or not. You know, it's experience, strength, and hope. It's like, that's what's helped me, you know. Add that to the advice you're giving, and you're automatically softening it, and you're making it easier for somebody to take if they want it.
My own sort of sense of right and wrong, I get this mixed up idea, and you that I'm ashamed of something I've done, mm-hmm. and I'm stewing in my shame, and I feel like I'm doing the work. I'm feeling bad. I'm doing, that's my penance, right? Yeah. As opposed to thinking, what can I do to correct this? What's the opposite of that? How can I sort of, you know, opposite thinking, right? What's the right way to do it, which is the work? But yeah, it's easy to get sort of feel like I deserve credit for all of the suffering I've gone through from, you know, hurting somebody else's feelings, for instance.
let me speak to something just real quick. We've got some time. So in LA, ICE has been kidnapping people off the streets. There's been an assault on neighborhoods and, you know, working people. And it's really awful. And I was hearing about some of this stuff when I was all the way out in Morocco. And of course, continued to kind of hear about it now that I'm back. The socializing with, you know, and especially with people in recovery, but not just with people in recovery, just with family and finding ways, big and small, to just be of service to other human beings, not just to talk to other human beings, but to like find some way to, like, I helped my mom's friend was having some technical problems with her computer yesterday. And I went over and figured it out and was able to kind of like really course correct some stuff she wanted to do for her day. I get so dark when I think about the state of the world and the socializing doesn't fix those problems, but it helps to kind of order my mind in a way so that I'm not just kind of veering into this, like, I'm not going to say nihilism, but just like a real despair about, like, you know, I think if I get too big in what I'm, in the way that I'm thinking, you know, I get really unmoored, and I'm just like, I find it difficult to like take some kind of positive action. And so I think, and then so this could probably apply in a lot of different contexts, but for me, the state of the world in the state of America is real dark. It's that connection with other people that keeps me from doing something real stupid.
Yeah. Well, and that's, thank you for that, because I mean, but that's one of the things that the Stoicism helps me with, because it doesn't, I mean, all of that is there and real and felt, and it's like, but you know, the message, and I think emotional sobriety is very much the same thing, but what it does is it comes right back to my own personal responsibility. Still, the only things I control are right here. You know, and I've got to work from this space, and you do a good job with that. I mean, part of that's just communicating, part of that's letting know somebody, doing what you can do, but also, you know, it doesn't mean, because other people are suffering, that we all have to join them in suffering in the acute stage. We need to feel it. We need to do that kind of stuff. But because to me, that's what immobilizes, has mobilized me, is I get, if I just get into the hurt and the injustice of it all, I mean, in the way I used to always get really, and I still can get into, I would just get lost in my anger. You know, I was just, whether I was doing it outwardly or not, I was raging. And that's a little bit like what Joe was saying about sitting in his shame. It's understandable. It's natural, but it's not helping.
I mean, going to the Stoic reading about anticipating, like you can start the day by anticipating things are going to happen that I don't like. Things are going to happen that I object to. I'm going to come across people who aren't helpful, who are selfish, who are obstructing me from getting what I want. People are going to have a value system that's different than mine and demand that everybody else follow it. I'm going to have thoughts that they should do the same. You know, you're right, but you're wrong, so do it my way. And the emotional sobriety component of this is if I come across an injustice, I can't allow myself to go so far as to hate them because then I become them.
Right? It's the hardest part, man. It's the hardest part.
You know, and but I can't do nothing. I can't be overwhelmed either, right? You know, as a northern cousin, you know, living in Canada, right? Mm-hmm. Next month, there are some elections, like where you are, for like 27,000 positions. I mean, find somebody that you believe in their values and help with their campaign. There's something everybody can do sort of locally, right? You know, think globally, act locally, right? Yeah, you know, that, you know, find something, some actionable thing that can help. And doom scrolling and being in those toxic chat rooms might just be, you know, venting or letting off steam. What you know, maybe it's helpful. Maybe it'll change minds. I don't know. I haven't been there lately, but
stay out, Joe.
But what can I do to make a difference in this world?